LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Jonathan Harrison, who joins us to discuss his book, You Are This, Awakening to the Living Presence of Your Soul. Whether step by step or in the wake of sudden shocks, increasing numbers of people are questioning the meaning of their lives and that of the world around them. As a result, some are even drawn to doubt their own sanity. But what at first might appear as a disastrous disintegration of daily life may in fact emerge as a revitalizing rebirth, the dawning of a wider reality and a deeper sense of self, infinitely more meaningful than the maze of matter-of-fact materialism through which so many of us have wandered for millennia. But in rejecting the primacy of worldly being, do we run the risk of going too far? Is this life really an illusion, or does truth, reality, or any other concept we care to conceive of, reside beyond the domain of duality and non-duality? Whatever our worldview, atheist, agnostic, humanist, spiritual, religious, the list goes on, the integration of separate and divisive identities may hold the key to the next stage in human evolution as we awaken to the understanding that mind and matter both matter, and that all is one, just as all things are unique. Hello and welcome, Jonathan, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hi, Greg. Thanks very much for having me on. Really appreciate being invited. Thanks.
Now, today, Jonathan, we're going to be talking about some of the ideas in your recent book entitled You Are This, Awakening to the Living Presence of Your Soul. Before we jump into that, tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work in general.
Okay. Maybe for the last 20 years, I have had, or I started to have experiences 20 odd years ago, that suggested that life was not as I'd been told and the world was not as I'd been taught by my parents and people around me. And I decided to follow those experiences rather than shove them to the back of my mind and find out the truth of them. So my wife and I lived in France for 15 years, from 1995 to 2010, and our children were born out there. And I think we were looking for a quality of life which we felt had disappeared from the UK in some measure. And so we had 15 years out in France, which was a wonderful time of slowing down, of being in nature. We also worked very hard. And our two children were born out there. And basically, from being out there, my experiences became deeper, became more profound, and my questions and my following of that became more extreme, I suppose, and more continuous. And it became my life's interest and life's work to know what all these experiences and what other people's experiences were pointing to. And I wanted to know for myself. I wanted to know the truth without somebody telling me or reading it somewhere. I wanted to find it and experience it myself. And so that's what I did, I suppose, and I'm still doing to this day. And those experiences started off, as they often do, with an expansion of consciousness. One has things like starts with a gut feeling that becomes clear and true. Then you maybe start sensing things before they happen. Then you may start seeing things. and so on and so on. And your experiences become more and more expanded as your mind opens and your heart opens. And that's what happened to me. So I followed all those experiences, and that culminated really something that happened to me in 2007, which was a seizure that I had when I was living in France. And I basically collapsed in my house, fell to the floor, and was separated from my body, if that makes sense. And I was clearly able to see that I was not my body, without a shadow of a doubt. And I followed that experience, and I wrote a book in a few days after that experience, and that book went on to win an award in America. And so that gave me the confidence and the will to continue following it, you know, that there was some sense behind what I was following and trying to learn and understand. And not long after that, I had what people would call a non-dual experience, or non-experience if you're a non-dualist. And it transformed my consciousness. Those two events, really, the collapse and seeing of my body as being a different part of me or a different element of being, and then the non-dual realization that there is only this, there is only oneness. And yet, that wasn't it either, Greg, so I kept letting go of all those things, not wishing to sign up to anything, and just wishing to follow the experience. And I found that really what was missing from some of the things that I was hearing about non-duality was a dimension that I would call the soul, or Brunton called the over-self. And it was that element of heart and mind, the true, unique, but also universal human experience that I was looking for. And when I found it, I realized that was the, in a way, secret or mystery to fulfillment, was to find out who we are, but to find out who we are on all levels of being, not just from the ego and not from awareness or pure consciousness itself, but to take all experiences and to live them in the world. So that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years.
That event, as you say, the seizure that occurred in 2007, that's particularly dramatic. Prior to that, it sounds like there was a sort of gradual, you know, expanding of consciousness on one or more levels. It's interesting that you had this sequence of experiences, because I've talked to a lot of people about states of consciousness and the evolution thereof, and people generally fall into two camps. One is kind of, they seem to have been born was some kind of realization that this is not it, you know, in the sense that, you know, that what we are told is it and that is all there is not the case. Or they have some kind of fairly dramatic life event that completely changes their worldview. And it sounds like you all sort of had a bit of both. Now, you can look at, you know, physiological reasons perhaps for your seizure. I don't know medically what you discovered about what happened to you, but I've talked to so many people who've had something that superficially, you know, it could be kind of a heart attack, a stroke, an accident, or something really, you know, like lose their job, be declared bankrupt, lose their marriage and their kids, just some kind of thing that on the surface is like, you know, this could not be any worse, but it triggers something within them that changes their life ultimately for the better.
Yeah, it's very common, isn't it? And these experiences, I think, like you say, are very often a slow, gradual increase in experiences and expansion of consciousness, or an event. And like you say, I think my life experience has been both of those. So I had a gradual build up, but I also had a main event, I suppose, if you want to put it that way. And it certainly did change my consciousness and transform what I believed I was and what I think people really are. So it certainly did change me. And I think a lot of people can have experiences and shut them away and not wish to deal with them. and it's slightly embarrassing. And I think the more we can share these experiences and point out they're not really so weird and abnormal, I think the healthier it is for us all, and the more we'll learn from each other. So that's my view on that.
Well, it's interesting. I interviewed a guy called Randy Rogers, an American author, who's actually worked in TV and movies for many years. That's his actual day job, so to speak. And he had very similar sequence of experiences with him, mainly revolving around synchronicity. And he initially didn't want to talk to his wife about it because, or anyone else really for that matter, because he was convinced that people would think he was crazy. But eventually he just couldn't keep it in anymore. He started talking to his wife. His wife just thought he was losing his mind, didn't want to know, but then she was forced to confront evidence he was putting before her of, look, and she was going, oh, it's just coincidences. How could this possibly happen? The upshot of all that was that his marriage ended, and it was a long and painful process. Now, like I said before, it was for the best, but that was a guy that suppressed stuff and even questioned his own sanity for a while as a result of what he was undergoing.
Yeah, again, those things are quite common, I think, Greg, that if you're unable to share those experiences when they happen, there's some build-up and huge doubts and fears about one's own sanity. I can give you a few experiences where I've questioned my own sanity and yet they remain true to me. For example, walking down a drive in France to our house and feeling at one with everything and kneeling down, as bizarre as this may sound, and putting my hand down to a flower that was on the side of the road and wondering in my mind what that flower would say to me if it could speak. And I put my hand down and I naturally put both my hands around the flower. It's like a primrose, kind of a wild primrose on the side of the road. And I put my hands around it, and immediately I did that, I could see a purple ring around these flowers. And that was just enough for me. I didn't hear any words, or the flower didn't speak to me. On another hand, in another way, there was some sense of communication. Now, you try and explain that to somebody, or your wife, or a friend, or your mum and dad, or your brother, when it happens, and it's very difficult. And these things take time to ground in our consciousness and for us to be able to share them. But it's by far the best thing to share them, because we learn ourselves about the experiences, and we also share that knowledge with others who learn to share their experiences, and so it goes on.
Well, two things about that particular incident. One, I would say, if that's piqued anyone's interest, I've done a couple of shows based around plant consciousness, that is to say, potential intelligence in other than, just human realms. We can sense what we would call limited intelligence in animals, but I see a picture emerging increasingly where intelligence permeates everything, which ties in again with some of the ideas in your book. The other thing about your experience is that I have learnt to not write anything off because I simply can't. And the subjective nature of reality is another theme that's been emerging in the work I've been doing increasingly so as important. That you can't just say someone has an experience that is not shared by anyone else, that experience is somehow invalid. The subjectivity is, and again, I know scientists are just aghast in horror at the idea of subjectivity, but they experience it too, but if a hardcore materialist has a subjective experience that's disturbing, they'll probably file it under, that didn't really happen.
Mm. Well, wasn't there a time where scientists and people that knew thought the world was flat?
Well, yeah, that's one of the popular things that gets wheeled out, isn't it? There was all sorts of beliefs that we had, and that's what they were, beliefs. And and again, we have this idea of where we are now in the early 21st century, though I think this is beginning to unravel, but we certainly have had for quite some time since the scientific revolution, the idea that the answers are almost all in, and we're the peak of humanity in every conceivable way, and that we understand what's actually going on, whereas those who came before us were all kind of just a little bit crazy, living in a dream world. They were primitive, they were stupid, and that we're the peak of evolution.
Oh dear, that's a bit worrying, isn't it?
It is rather, but you know, there is that sense, you know, but of course that's somewhat to be expected, because I think that the Romans and the Greeks and possibly, I don't know, the ancient Egyptians, certainly previous civilizations, probably believed that they had pretty much arrived and they were the finished object and things could only get better from that point onward.
Mm. I sense, Greg, that we're actually babies coming out of nappies, possibly. You know, that's how it feels to me, that we're starting to grow up in terms of consciousness, or that we have an opportunity to grow up in terms of consciousness. And in order to take that opportunity, it's not about selling it to anybody else. It's about doing one's own work. If you do your own work, then that naturally contributes to the whole, to the worldview, to the worldview consciousness and to life on Earth. I know that sounds a bit idealistic, but I absolutely believe that to be true. And that's my experience. So if we each do our own work, and we each apply that in our lives, then change is afoot, basically.
Yeah, and what I was saying about some of these ancient civilizations, we can look back across the, you know, the sweep of centuries and millennia, and this seems like an impossibly long time for us because our average lifespans as human beings is relatively so short. But if you zoom out and look at that sweep of time in a wider perspective, it's nothing. You know, you think about this impossible length of time, how long ago it was that, since the dinosaurs died out, or our understanding is that that's what happened. And then you look back beyond that to see how long the dinosaurs were actually around in one form or another. And it's just absolutely mind-boggling to consider the scale of time. So where I'm going with this is that the idea that, you know, however long humans, you know, what we call modern humans, have existed on the Earth, is very short space of time, in fact. And there's no reason to think that the last 5,000, 10,000 years or whatever, or since the last ice age, however you want to peg it, in that time span that human beings could have done all the significant evolution that would bring us from, you know, a starting point to, you know, to something approaching the finished, let's say, the finished product. This idea that we're just getting started, I think, is completely valid. You know, there's a lot of pessimism around today that things are in decline, and, you know, there's two different perspectives. You know, there's a techno-utopian one. This is it. We're the greatest humans that have ever lived. And there's the other one, which is like, oh, we're all doomed and it's all over. And I don't think either of those really applies. I think that barring absolute outright disaster, I think there's going to be humans in some form on this planet for a very, very long time to come. And they will increasingly be different from us, I think.
Well, I hope that's the case, and indeed that's the natural evolution of human consciousness. That must be the way that we can see our own positive impact in the world and also our negative impact in the world. We can see that our activities are now having a significant impact on the Earth's geology and the ecosystems. We can see that through climate change, through all sorts of different ways in the world today. And it's actually being acknowledged by scientists now. So there is a negative aspect to it, but I believe the negative aspect is also a sign of growth and change and a new human, if you like, a human that is deeply conscious, deeply aware of all that it is, rather than just one aspect, rather than isolated state of being, a whole human, if you like, a new human, a human that is evolving beyond Homo sapiens and sapiens, whatever you want to call it. So Homo novus, the new man, that's what's happening. There is a new solidification of consciousness happening in the world today, albeit slowly but surely. And that is our hope, because that is the way out and the way forward for all people.
To put what we're talking about into the sort of wider context of your book, perhaps we should say something about the ego, about dualism and non-dualism, because not everyone will be familiar with those terms in the context you're speaking about. And there's something about the ego and the individual versus wholeness, oneness, and just try and tie those ideas in with the sort of what people would consider the practical day-to-day stuff that we've been discussing so far.
Okay. Where should we start?
Well, perhaps the dualism, non-dualism, in terms of a view of reality, a worldview, whatever, what those are.
Yeah, okay. So the way I understand it, Greg, is that the ego, or as I call it in the book, the me-go, because it's all about me, is a view, a consciousness that is all about itself and all about separation. And because it's separate and has no conception of its wholeness, of its innate wholeness, of its oneness, of its divinity, because it doesn't get that, it remains in fear and isolation. And if a consciousness remains in fear and isolation, then it remains open to destructive and negative ways and self-interested ways, ways that only benefit itself or that itself is the priority. Now, when you're living in a planet with 7.4 billion people, that's certainly a selfish way of living. And we can see that the materialistic way of living, of having as much as we can have in order to be something we're not, is completely nuts. And I think more and more people are getting that. We are now in the UK having we have most things. We've become more materialistic. We've been able to buy and treat ourselves to more things than ever before, and our debts have grown consequently too. And yet that's not enough. There's something missing. So then as humans, we go and search for something deeper. And from the mind of the ego, we tend to leap into the opposing pole of the mind, which we consider, when we're looking for it, to be non-ego, or not the home of the ego. So the mind purges itself by leaping from the ego to the non-ego. And the true non-ego is a non-dual state. Now, non-duality is about a state of consciousness, or the true state of consciousness, some people would say, or reality, without any separation whatsoever. Now, it is possible to experience non-duality from the depths of one's consciousness when the mind is absolutely empty and stilled and completely aware. Then one realizes that there is no separation, there is no other. God is not otherly to you, there is no other at all. And everything is one, it is inseparable. And so it's a completely different experience that we can have from the mind of ego to the non-mind of non-ego. So from duality to non-duality. But the truth of non-duality is even beyond that, because the truth of non-duality is about seeing the two-ness and the oneness as inseparable. By seeing that everything is one, and yet all things are unique. And I believe that if we want to put a name on that, just so we can conceptualize what we're talking about, that would be the soul, because the soul is neither a part or the whole. It's a whole part, and it's the lost consciousness of humankind in that respect. So I believe it's something we had, something we lived in knowledge of, and something that we lost as the mind became the mind of ego, the mind of materialism, the mind of self-orientation became the dominant foreground of consciousness. And the way forward is not to try and destroy duality or to just destroy non-duality, is for those two to be a living presence as one, so that everything is one and all things are unique. And I believe then you get to realize your soul in this world doing what you need to be doing for the whole.
In several interviews recently, I have mentioned a book called Saving the Appearances by Owen Barfield. This is a book that came out, I believe, in the 1950s. The reason I mention it is because he's talking about the evolution of human consciousness. And he talks about this idea that you mentioned, that there was a state of consciousness that we moved away from, that we lost. But he contends that there is no going back to some earlier state of consciousness, but rather what we're experiencing then and now is this forward movement, that the only way is to go forward to something else. And when you read some of the literature around consciousness and where we are now and the ego, there is quite a lot of polarization still. People saying the ego must be absolutely dissolved. There's no such thing as the individual, or, you know, we must go back to how we used to be, you know, thousands of years ago, or the ego is absolutely necessary to be in the world. And this idea of dissolving the ego is anti-human. You know, we become formless and the individual is lost and annihilated and everything else. So my current mode of thinking, my instinct, my intuition is that this is part of a process that we're undergoing, possibly necessary, but we're moving forward. We can't go back as such. You know, to stay in the Garden of Eden forever was not going to serve us. We somehow had to come out of there and go through what we're going through.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Greg, because I think going back to the Garden of Eden scenario, which I've also used in the book as pointing to a soul consciousness, the way that we kind of came out of a soul consciousness. The thing is, what's different now is that we're aware, or we can be aware, that we came out of it. The coming out of it was a step in itself, but today we can be aware that we came out of it and go back into it in a different way with the knowledge that we have stepped forward. So I think they're both right in a way, paradoxically. We were in a soul consciousness at whatever time in the past, that's my sense, but also that we stepped out of it to know that we could step out, to know what would happen if we step out of it, and to know how to live that in a modern understanding, in a future world. And I think that's vitally important that those lessons are learnt and understood.
I remember watching Peter Russell's little documentary, The Global Brain, back in the 1980s. He actually based this on his book, The Global Brain. And although the idea of an internet already existed within the military at that time and before, this was one of the first times I was exposed to the idea of a worldwide technological network that was something other than the telephone network. And I remember at school in the early 80s, we had, you know, having a network within one classroom of computers all linked together. And I started to think about what that would be like on a global scale. And I don't think it occurred to me or Peter Russell or almost anyone what it could actually look like the way it does now. And I think this technology is incredibly important because, you know, that the technology extends from our consciousness too. It's a product of it. And I see it as incredibly beneficial, but there's definitely some side effects that we would describe as undesirable. Let's put it that way. So, there's the idea of technology facilitating to some extent. You know, some people very much buy into this, other people are not so sure, but I think it's got a very important role in the evolution of consciousness. And then, of course, you have the downside. We're told that the biggest single, the biggest single sector on the internet is pornography. And we have social media, for example, which, you know, I take part in that, but partly as a way of monitoring what's going on. And that, in many ways, amplifies the materialist worldview of, you know, because people are comparing themselves to other people and it's about what you can get. And it tends to heighten people's anxiety about who they are, what they've done, what they have. So it's an interesting sort of polarity there.
Yeah, for sure. The internet and technology is an interesting, unlimited possibility in many ways, but it's essentially about use and intention. So it's about what we use it for and what's the intention behind that use that will deliver either benefit to you and to others or not. So it's kind of interesting. I think you're so right that young people today particularly are getting so caught up in comments and likes on social media. I mean, I know I've got two young children, so they're very much into all that kind of stuff. And the sort of conditioning that comes through the social media is one of the negative sides of what it's all about. And yet, the source of information on the internet is an incredible thing. I know that I've used it at times in the past, particularly to follow things, to follow stories, to follow histories where synchronicities linked people to people or stories to stories. And that's certainly a wealth of information out there, which is about sharing, which is, again, the way we're going to learn is really about sharing, sharing our experiences, sharing our knowledge, sharing our gifts, creating a better world for us all. And technology has that potential as a tool, depending on the use and depending on your intention.
I can't remember the exact form of words that you use in the book, but there's an allusion to the idea of humanity as a sort of a petulant teenager or a spoilt child. And that very much resonates with me in terms of where we are in our evolution. And I think that taking that as maybe the collective state of consciousness, even if there's individual differences, and, you know, change and evolution is underway, the internet very much brings home to us that, you know, the global really is the personal writ large. And I think this has always been the case, you know, even in thousands of years ago, but now it's just so obvious and it's so instantaneous as well. You know, the collective of humanity would manifest things globally in millennia gone by, but now this can happen. One person can have a thought, an idea, one individual ego. This can be communicated in theory with not the entire world, but a big chunk of it in a split second. And the idea can be taken up, developed, praised, denounced, turned into something else. You know, it can become an industry, a religion, a cult, a business, whatever it happens to be, some global movement or other. And this can all happen in a very, very short space of time. And again, it's neither here nor there, good or bad. It is what it is. But it's a very powerful phenomenon. It's incredible to watch. It's like something changing exponentially now. If you see, like one of those computer programs that used to, you know, start out with a very limited understanding of what it was doing, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. And then you find out that not only is it learning as time goes on, but the rate of that is increasing. And it's just amazing to think about where things will be even this time next year.
Yeah, the speed of it all has taken over, hasn't it? And the potential's there for sure. The question is, say, what do you choose to use it for? You know, what do we want to use it for as a species? Not as an individual, but as a species. And I think you're right that some beautiful idea or some positive business venture or some creative aspect on the internet can have a huge impact all over the world. And yet, as I pointed out in the book, we're still in a world where, you know, we can't give fresh water to children in, you know, in the third world. That's just shocking. And we can go to the moon, we can blow up things with atom bombs, we can create many things, good and bad, or whatever you want to call them, but we still haven't given each other fresh water. It's the fundamental. Fresh water, food, housing. Let's get the fundamentals right then, and then take it from there. Then, you know, there's a sense we're doing something right. But, you know, there are, I think I put in the book, there are 2,300 people per day dying from diarrhea because of poor quality of water. I mean, that's just, seems a shocking waste, seems wrong, feels wrong, and I sense it's wrong. And the more we can connect and share these ideas and get the basics right, it's not about huge things necessarily, it's about the basics, getting the basics right, putting yourself in another person's shoes who hasn't got fresh water, who's got to walk 13 miles a day with a plastic can to get some water and walk all the way home, you know? Let's get the basics right, and then I think if we can do that as a group of human beings, business will be forced to follow and support all these other initiatives, and that could create very positive change in the world.
Well, I know from reading your bio that you've got a musical background, and us being of a similar vintage, perhaps you sat down in 1985 to watch Live Aid on the telly, and I remember thinking even then, wanting to sort of say to Bob Geldof and Bono and Midgeyear and the rest of them, do, you know, with the best will in the world, guys, do you really think that if the will was there, that these people couldn't be fed? Because the food's there. If you see what I mean, the infrastructure may not be very good, but certainly we could get food to these people. And yet here we are after all this time. And as I understand it, the situation's a lot better than it was then. But as you point out, there's people dying in large numbers every day for all sorts of largely unnecessary, or at least theoretically unnecessary reasons. I think that this is something that I have to see the potential for change in these areas because of global communications, because of the internet, because of how instantaneous it can all be. I mean, we remember back then in the 80s, people talked about those images appearing on television news, you know, of the little Ethiopian kids like sticks, like walking skeletons covered in flies, and people were shocked and motivated to do something. And then it, well, didn't really last very long. And they came back again and again with similar campaigns. But I see two reactions now to how globalized and how rapidly information about trouble and strife and, you know, need is spread. And one is, you know, an instantaneous, we must do something about this, and people step into action. But then it's like, well, here's another thing and another thing. And it seems to me there's hundreds and thousands of causes, and this can cause people to kind of shut down a little bit and say, well, there's just so much trouble in the world, I can't do anything about it. So it can become difficult to gauge. You know, in 1985, for example, we're talking about the crisis that Live Aid came up to respond to. Is there really less of that now? Is it more different? Because the delivery system for the information has changed so much, it can be very difficult to gauge sometimes.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, Greg. And, you know, putting that back into the spiritual journey or the journey of the realization of who we are, I think there are stages, and I've listed those in the book as a way of trying to understand them. First of all, there's a recognition of a deeper consciousness. There is a realization of that consciousness. And then there's the actualization of that consciousness in the world. And, you know, it's a bit like going from duality, the duality of the ego, to the non-duality of the non-ego, shall we say, and getting stuck in that place. And many, many people are stuck in that place where there is no person, there is nobody here to speak, there is no personality. And, you know, the point is to get to actualization, to actually be doing something about it from the depths of who we are, not just to recognize a problem, and not just to realize the ins and outs of that problem and to clearly see it, but to actualize a cure, to actualize something in the world that's of benefit to the whole. And the window for that, I believe, is the soul. And I'm still harking on about the soul, but we've forgotten about the soul. We've forgotten about the consciousness that says, yeah, we're all interconnected, but we've also got individual journeys. And not separating out those two potentials, those two realities, as the mind tends to do. So everything is one and all things are unique, are both absolutely true to a person who's conscious of their soul. And they're also conscious that each soul has the same luminosity, has the same value. And if that's the case, you see, if we get to that point in the world of realizing our soul, realizing the soul that we are, beyond duality and non-duality and all these other words, we cannot help but to enact change and action in the world. We cannot help to be a catalyst of something better. And I think that's what we're walking towards. And I believe that's a stepping stone that we're approaching that you referred to earlier. A transformational stepping stone in human consciousness. And, you know, it's time we had it, really.
Yeah, I think that's one of the unattractive aspects of the sort of non-ego. This sort of, I don't know if it is actually Buddhist or pseudo sort of Buddhist idea that the world as we see it is mana, is illusion, and therefore this can lead some people almost to like say, well, I'm going to meditate and that's about it, you know, and therefore because the world's illusion, you know, famine, war, pestilence, death, it's an illusion. And that has its downside every bit as much as someone completely mired in the ego and materialist perspective has. And I mentioned that we've made this point already, but in the context of the problems, that I was speaking about and the response that you spoke about, it makes a lot more sense to find that middle way.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've lived in illusion, personally. I lived several years in illusion, I'm going to say. And that illusion that I lived in was a non-dual illusion. I'm going to say that my mind was so focused and so, I'm going to say at peace, but focused on everything being one, that there's a tendency to not manifest anything in the world. There's a tendency to withdraw from the world. It's a spiritual bypass, a stepping away from the world. And, you know, how can anybody say that life is an illusion if they've ever been in love, or if they've ever had a child born? You know, if they've had their own, looked into the eyes of their newborn child, is that an illusion? If that is, then I think we've got a problem, because those are the human aspects that make us sing. You know, those are the things that the power of creativity, the joy of creating something. Where does that come from? An ego will say, well, it's all about me. Somebody else in the opposing state of consciousness, or in a non-dual intellectual state, would say, well, it's nothing to do with me whatsoever. There is no me. So, yeah, it's that bridge, it's that middle road, it's the soul saying, yeah, it's about me, and it's not about me, and that's okay, and I don't need to separate them out. What it is a sense that change is a requirement, as well as a necessity, and a change is what's happening, is going to happen anyway, but now, today, in 2016, we have a choice of how that change manifests in the world. Now, that's where we're going. That's the new form of consciousness. We have a choice, and we can learn from all our history and from all our past mistakes and errors. Do you really want to just keep repeating the same things, or do we want to step out of the nappies and put some long trousers on, you know, and get with all people in the world, you know, that it's helping you and others simultaneously without separation? So it has to be something that bridges the two. It cannot be one without the other. It's both and neither. And that's the paradox of the soul.
Well, you used the phrase spiritual bypass, and that's one that also features in the book. And I think that really applies. You can see the addictions, kind of materialist addictions to what you can have, what you can get, houses, cars, boats, holidays, all the rest of it. A sort of a version of that in an addiction to seeking. And this is something that I've come across moving in various circles and, you know, socializing and meeting people, is that there's a certain type of individual who is always looking for the next thing, the next spiritual practice, and that they're trying to get somewhere, and that there's always this development going on. And in a sense there is, but it's this idea that, you know, rather than you're here now and everything that you are already is, everything that you can be kind of already is, in a way, it's a matter of uncovering it. You'll certainly see that as it when the profusion of books by, you know, various gurus, and you can do this and you can do that and you can be that. And obviously this material that's there's such a profusion of now is a spectrum like everything else. There's very good information out there. There's pretty useless and superficial information out there. But if you tie that in with a general uncertainty with many people about what an awakened or enlightened state actually looks like, people can say they can declare themselves enlightened in some way and be very far from it. I've certainly met people and met people who've met people who claim to be awakened or enlightened, and they were very, very far from it. And it reminded me of nothing. Well, again, I'm saying that, but then people might be saying, oh, well, what's your version? What do you believe that to be? I understand the potential contradiction there. But it reminds me of nothing less than meeting and having the misfortune to deal with a couple of church ministers in decades gone by. One of them was a Baptist, actually, who were absolutely despicable individuals, double-dealing hypocrites, if you see what I mean, in my opinion. So, not saying that everyone who claims to be awakened or enlightened is hiding some sort of dark side, but there's just this general, there's this soup out there, this sea of material about seeking, about spiritual practice. And from all that, it can be very difficult. It can be very easy to get lost in it. It can be very difficult to know what to take away from it.
I'm picking up on the points there because my job, my role for 4 years between 2010 2014, when I came back to England, was to run one of the biggest spiritual retreats and holistic education centres in the UK. And part of my job there was to interview and selectively interview workshop leaders. So people from all around the world who came to run workshops or wanted to run workshops at a large centre in the UK. Excuse me. So that was interesting in itself, because as you can imagine, you would not only just have a meeting or two meetings with somebody who wanted to run a workshop. You could learn to ask the right questions and to find out if they were authentic as much as one can. And it was really interesting, you know, that you said about enlightened and awakened, and that's something I hark out on about in the book, is that this isn't about being awakened as in it's finished, or enlightened and it's all over. It's about awakening. You're in the process of awakening. That's what you're doing in the world. That's what you're doing on Earth. And that gives a humility to that understanding, and it also drops the seeking aspect of it. And again, it's part of the soul's consciousness to know that it is awakening, or that the personality is awakening to the presence of the soul. So you're neither awakened or ignorant. Again, it's a living paradox. So, yeah, I really understand when you say about these people going around saying they're this and that. I had to work closely with them. And that's why, part of the reason I wrote some of that stuff in the book about awakening rather than awakened. Authentic people are always awakening. That's how I see it.
There is this sense of increasing numbers of people looking for something other than just what's stuck on a plate right in front of them. There has to be more to it than this, I guess, is how you would sum it up. And one manifestation of this I see outside of some of the areas that we're talking about, perhaps more in the mainstream or more from a materialist point of view, is, well, say psychotherapy, but that's a bit drastic, that, you know, you're on a couch here with your shrink. But taking that as one of the more extreme ends of it, but, you know, several steps down from that as well, are people are kind of got an inkling that there should be more to life than this, and their dissatisfaction with their lot. But depending, if they're coming from a very hardcore materialist point of view, it can be very difficult to see where that might be, because by definition, such a person is not going to turn to religion, and they're probably going to be very skeptical about some of the ideas that we're discussing. But nonetheless, they're still being pushed. Even people, and I've known people actually, you know, with the nice big house and the two cars and the kids in private school and all the rest of it, having this cognitive dissonance about, is this it? Then it's like, no, this isn't it. But they don't know what to do, where to turn, because they have certain beliefs, and that's what all they are, about the parameters of themselves and who they are and what reality is, you know. So that can be an interesting kind of trajectory in itself. And I think some of those people who end up having change through crisis rather than gradual change.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the, I'm going to say very wealthy people, not that I know many very wealthy people, but the few that I do know, and I'm talking seriously wealthy, are extremely unhappy. Now, they're not unhappy because they haven't got things. They're unhappy because something is incomplete within them. It's not an outer worldly thing. It's an inner worldly thing. And so that's why I'd go back again to the soul. I go back to realizing who we are, to recognizing, realizing, and actualizing in that three-step process in the world. And that was an interesting thing, and kind of funny when you think of my book, which is called You Are This. You're saying that people were saying, well, there's got to be more than this. And that's the joke, really, because underneath everything, in a pure-minded state, I'm going to say in pure consciousness, where there is no commentary of the mind and there's just awareness, there is only this.
Well, you have an entire glossary, though, in your book in terms of, you know, because you're taking words like this and words like you. I mean, even if you look at the cover of your book, you've got you are this, and you've got you and this are in capitals.
Yeah.
So for people who do get the book, it'll be interesting to explore how you expand some of these terms and how you contract others and how you completely change some others about ways of thinking. But yeah, it also makes me think about our use of language as well, the limitations thereof.
Yeah, very much so. And to say a recent thing I saw the other day, which has caught my interest, was how Shakespeare, not that I'm Shakespeare, but how Shakespeare invented 1700 words to explain things better or to give a better picture. And why shouldn't we invent words? Why shouldn't we play around with words? Because by playing around with words, we are creating something new, potentially. We are shedding light on something that's maybe left in a dark corner, and we need to discuss it and bring it to the fore. So words are a very powerful way of understanding or of sharing concepts and sharing ideas and sharing ways and means of change. And so, yeah, I've definitely played about with words, and I see that as a very useful way of explaining things, to understand you when you're, what do I mean by me? What do I mean by I when I'm in the ego? What do I mean by I when non-duality is at the foreground of consciousness? Or is there an I? Or what is the I? Who am I? I am, you know, all these kind of things. So to go through that whole process, and as we do, the identity of who you are changes. So the you that I'm looking at, so you, Greg, as your journey continues and unfolds, same as mine or anybody else's, your identity, your reference point, will also change. Your understanding of who you are in its totality will change. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we need to appreciate that that's the case, that the identity changes from a dual to a potentially non-dual identity or non-identity, and then settles in something, because the non-dual experience takes time to ground in consciousness. The non-dual experience is outside of time and space and form. It's outside of all that. And the non-dual experience is just reconfirms to us that being consciousness bliss is all there is. There's just this. There's just absolute oneness. And to live in that state is, I would imagine, a slightly bizarre and unhelpful thing. And to be driven back to that state, constantly driven back to that state with your mind, I think that's also another potential form of addiction, to just keep repeating that there's nobody here, there is no person, there is no I. That is a misunderstanding of some opportunity to grow deeper in terms of consciousness. Because, you know, it's about your head and your heart. It's about the two. It's about the two as one. It's all those things. So, it's not about separating out things and cutting them up. It's about seeing them as one living whole. So, in a way, there is only this. kind of makes me laugh.
With a recent guest on here, a guy called Gary Lachman, and he was writing about Western esoteric traditions, and something you just said reminded me of a conversation I had with him, and he talked about the need for a new language of mysticism. And what he was getting at is that our language was inadequate to communicate certain concepts and ideas. And he talked about the importance of symbolism in magic and mysticism in general, esoteric traditions, and how symbols can communicate more than language sometimes. And this does make me think about what you're saying about developing, you know, new words to communicate new ideas. And I wonder what the future of the species will be in those terms. It's possible we could go back to a more symbolic way of thinking. I'm not sure. Can we transcend language at a purely practical level? I've speculated with other guests about developments of non-verbal communication, telepathy, just to give it a name. If you see what I mean. So I do see, in all of what I'm discussing here, certain limitations, and I've certainly been lost for words many times trying to communicate an idea. And it's a strange feeling, because ultimately I think the way I'd sum it up is that we know, in terms of, you know, intuition and our heart, our gut, whatever, however you want to express it, we know more than we can say.
Yes, that's so true. I think you're right, and your previous guest made an interesting point about symbols, the power of symbols. How is it that you can look at a symbol and know information from it? You have a sense or a feeling from it, and it gives, there's an exchange. There's an exchange of consciousness from looking at a symbol. I don't know if you've ever stared at any yantras, you know, the Hindu symbols. That's kind of an interesting thing. And how that one's interpretation of that symbol changes as your consciousness expands. So you might look at it 1 year and think, oh, I can only just see a pretty pattern. 2 years later, you go and say, well, that, you know, you're really focused on one area of it, or one area draws you. It's a really interesting concept how symbols and language can change the way we think. Absolutely no doubt I have that that's true. And like you say, I think that's part of the evolutionary process that's unfolding. That maybe we could write a book one day with just symbols in it to express all sorts of ideas. In fact, it's quite a good idea. I might try and do it.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Yeah, I just love the idea that, you know, you look at, you know, a circle or a cross or a triangle. And I've always kind of been quite interested in symbols from quite a young age, as to what they kind of suggest or mean. And that's throughout our history. You know, you can go back and see these shapes and forms in medieval alchemy, in the ancient Greeks, Egyptians, etc., etc. And maybe there's lots of information from just looking at a symbol. And of course, what we need to do from that is then to share that with another person. So, you know, there is a duality that comes into play from our own awareness. So, you know, from what we're seeing, and then sharing that with another and discussing it, that's where the real growth comes in. It doesn't come from sitting in a comfortable place. It comes from the rub, or the rub of duality, from the yin and yang, from the Brahman Atman relationship, from the two rubbing together creates a new growth.
Well, you mentioned yin and yang there. If you think of the symbol for that, how much that communicates, or how much it suggests, you know, how it could be interpreted. So in so many different ways. And then the first one, when I started to talk about symbols, the first thing I thought of was a swastika. You put a swastika anywhere now, how powerful that is, what an effect it has on people's consciousness. And then you think about the original swastika, you know, from thousands of years ago, and you flipped it. You flip the symbol and you use it for something else, associate it with something else, and they couldn't be much further apart.
Yeah, that's just an interesting concept to follow, isn't it? How we can use symbols to create change, positive and negative, that's true. But it's the intention we have behind the sharing of that symbol, of those words, that leads to something manifesting in the world.
Just a final thought about addiction as such. In a conventional Western materialist worldview, we talked about addiction to material things and to having and getting. I also see in the increasing physical addictions, you know, like drugs and alcohol, for example, or it could be, well, use those because in the other having and getting, you could also include sex addiction, you know, addiction to sensual pleasure, whatever it happens to be. But in drugs and alcohol, I see an interesting process is going on, because on one level, I call immersion in substances like that as hiding from something, hiding from yourself, hiding from something, you know, just trying to block something out, some kind of emptiness, you know, trying to fill something. But also at the same time, maybe even simultaneously in one individual, there's a kind of a craving, a seeking for some kind of altered state, some integrated consciousness that maybe you can get a fleeting glimpse of. after a couple of drinks, after a couple of pills, maybe just, you know, a bigger reality can be revealed to you, but then ultimately does, you know, you don't quite get there. It's like you get a glimpse of it and then the emptiness is back again. So it's just an interesting processes, I think, in underlying that.
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. And I understand that from my time in the music business, how people seek that high and how they choose to do it is, you know, fundamental in how long it lasts. And I think it is possible to have a high that will last, that is timeless, that is beyond the mind, if you like, beyond the understanding of the mind. Because if you can strip back everything, it's like you said earlier, you're uncovering it. That's exactly the truth as I see it too. If you can strip back the layers of your mind and all this kind of, I'm not going to say false stuff, but illusory and unnecessary stuff, if you can strip back to the bare truth of who you are, then we will all discover we're all the same as each other. Now, but that's not enough. That's not enough to solve or to act out as human beings in the world. It's not enough to know that we're all the same. I know that we're all the same. It's a difficult thing to explain. And I know the truth at the heart of consciousness, which is absolute being, consciousness, bliss, or as I called it, I've got to think what I called it, intelligent love and peace of mind. Because when one comes out of a true non-dual experience, the first thing you feel, because you can't think as such and you can't verbalize it, the first experiences one has, or sensual experiences one has as one returns to a multidimensional human consciousness, is, wow, that was amazing kind of thing. And I haven't got to think about anything. You know, so you feel whole, you feel loved, and you feel complete. So, you know, uncovering that is then a stepping stone to something else, is a stepping stone to the soul. What it would be pointless would be to endlessly recreate that experience. But to do something about that experience, to do something from that experience, to act from that experience in an authentic way that's inclusive of all that you are, not one element or just awareness or just from oneself and one's own point of view, but to act in a holistic way that's grounded, that encompasses all that we are. That's the way to change and action in the world. And I think that's, you know, that's the chapter of human evolution we're walking into. Consciousness itself is not evolving. Human consciousness is evolving. Consciousness doesn't have a need to evolve. We do.
I'm struck by the similarities, the sort of synchronicities between what you're speaking about, is there being something fundamentally underlying everything. And, you know, we have our top level that we experience, and you go back and under, beyond, whatever expression you want to use, to get to this, to something unified is probably the best way to express it. I'm struck by similarities with that and what has been revealed to us by quantum physics, actually. And I think in more ways than one, there's links here. Sort of unified, unified reality. Let's go with reality, and some kind of unified physical reality. Even physical is not the right word. This is really, I'm finding this increasingly, actually, that however many words I've got in my head, I just don't quite ever seem to have the right one in some situations. But anyway, the idea of an underlying ground of being that science is pointing to, albeit somewhat reluctantly at times, and some of the ideas about that we've been talking about and you express in the book.
Yes, I have looked into the science of it, not in great detail, because I've always followed the experiential side primarily. But in the last few years, I've learnt to cross-reference the experience with our present understanding, which reveals a kind of holistic truth which interests me as a way of explaining and sharing things. So, yeah, there is a fundamental unity in terms of the mystical experience, and there is a fundamental unity in terms of quantum physics and our scientific understandings. And I think the two are converging. I think they'll continue to converge because I believe the mystical experience is a true seeing, and I believe the scientific experience is an analysis of the truth itself. So science will always keep on moving towards the truth. Those truths will change over hundreds of years. Of course they will. But there's no doubt, in my understanding, that the energy of the mind, and I don't mean your thoughts and emotions, your psyche and all that, I mean the energy behind your mind, the pure state of your mind, or mind in its purest state, is no different from pure energy consciousness. All these words become almost irrelevant because they converge. You know, that's another paradox of all this stuff. Like you say, the words almost become useless, but pure energy consciousness, you know, if we don't use the mind to separate those words out, we kind of feel there's something in that pure energy consciousness. And that the mind is, you know, it's just because we call it the mind and refer to it the mind, it also doesn't mean that the mind is something that comes and goes. That there may be a unified aspect of mind, a grounded form of awareness from which all things come from and all things live within. It pervades all things. The pure consciousness of the mind, and I'm again using mind in its purest form, so awareness itself is pure energy consciousness. There's no difference. And, you know, to discuss these things is almost irrelevant. It's difficult to share, but the more we try to confront these things, the more we'll share, you know, come closer to realizing and recognizing and actualizing the truth.
Well, one thing I think that that your book in particular can really help point people towards is how to integrate some of these ideas into their daily lives. Because whatever perspective people are coming from, I've met people who are very, very much materialistic, and they see some of these ideas we're talking about as having no relevance to their daily lives. It's kind of new age stuff, whatever, spiritual, you know, nothing to do with going to work and paying the bills and all the rest of it. And I talk to people who are very much at the sort of, you know, there is no me, there is no I, reality is an illusion perspective. And they believe that they're in their own way, that they're integrating this into their daily lives by opting out of what for most people is daily life. So I think that really this is this wider perspective. And we've talked about some of this in terms of, you know, responding to issues in our personal lives and with, you know, global issues and what have you. And I think this wider perspective really offers a kind of like a light bulb moment to integrate things and to make sense of things that when looked at separately appear very, you know, atomized and confusing and nonsensical.
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. And I think that's the thing. The mind as we used it or as we have used it in the past has tended to separate things or to bring things together as one and not accept that maybe the two are okay. So not to accept as in the yin-yang symbol we were talking about, the two are one in that. That's a very powerful symbol. To me, that is a symbol of the soul, of the living presence of the soul in the world. The Atman-Brahman relationship, the part, the unique single part that is not truly single because it's also universal. It's conscious of its universality. It's a whole part, as I call it in the book. And I think getting these words again over and trying to understand these concepts, is an important part of our spiritual journey. And that's why I had a little chapter at the end, The Paradoxes of the Soul, in the book. Because if we really read those with an open mind and accept the paradox, we are approaching or living in that space or on the bridge between duality and non-duality as souls in the world. So little things like the soul is not personal, and yet it is yours. So we've got the two again, always these two becoming one, always the two becoming neutralized. So no soul is identical, yet all souls are unified. See, the mind says, how can that be? How can it be that we are not the same, and yet we're all the same, we're all one? The mind wants to dissect that, and the soul sits with the truth that it is divine in its aspect, but not the divine. It doesn't have a need to be the divine. So it has a divine element, and it also has a deeper understanding of what that means.
Yeah, and I love the way that just ties, just a little last thought on science, how that ties so many of these ideas together. You know, the power of paradox and kind of how to accept that we have this very much either-or view in life, very much in science, but this increasing picture of and also, if you see what I mean, that something can be something, it can be something else, it can be two things at once. And that, if you look at science, you look at particularly sort of quantum science, quantum computing, you're starting to see this. It's that and it's that, but it's that and it's also that. And it's a fundamental challenge to our now accepted way of seeing things.
Yeah, it's the old, it's a challenging Aristotelian logic, you know, that kind of yes or no, the black and white, the good and bad, all those kind of things, which is one of the things I put in the book. There's a section on water. If you were water, then answer me the question, what is water? You know, so it says it. So you're water, okay? Are you a visible liquid or an invisible gas? But of course, water can be both of those, you know? And then water can also be a solid form of ice. So we're only limited to the understanding of our own experience. You know, that's really all we can reference. That's really all we can share. But there is definitely an answer that the soul would give all the time, in my understanding, which is both and neither. It would always give both and neither as an answer, you know. Am I dual or non-dual? Well, both and neither. Because they're words of the old mind. They're ways of describing something which we're coming out of. So they're referencing something which is dying, which has had its day. And the new mind, the new way of the mind, will accept truths, will converge two poles, the yes and the no, and by converging those two poles, the Atman and the Brahman, one gets to see a fuller picture, in a way a whole picture, without assuming that one is completely finished and whole and awakened and enlightened. One gets to realize that one has a purpose and a role in the world as an equal soul.
Well, Jonathan, today we've been discussing your book. Just to remind listeners, it's called You Are This, Awakening to the Living Presence of Your Soul. That's already available. It's out there. It's been published. So just share anything else you'd like to about that. You've got several other books, fiction and non-fiction, available. Give folks the details of your website and just anything else you want to put out.
Yeah, sure. That's very kind of you, Greg. Thanks. I've got a website which is authorjmharrison.com. If you go there, you'll see the books that I've got out. I've got four books, basically, three non-fiction books, a couple of which won awards in America, which I was very happy to receive. And I've just recently written a non-fiction book called The Soul Whisperer, which, again, sows the seeds of all these ideas in a kind of adventure story, a spiritual adventure story. It's kind of the Celestine Prophecy meets the Da Vinci Code. It's that kind of thing. And I hope you'll have a read of that too, and have a look on my website. If there's any questions that you would like to ask me, there is a contact page at the end of the website. You're very free, and I invite you to send me any questions you may have, and if I can be of help or discuss something with you, then I'd be delighted to do that. And I'd just like to say thank you to Greg for having me on, and have a good day.
Oh, well, thank you, Jonathan, so much for joining us today on LegaliseFreedom.com. Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegaliseFreedom.com. That's Legalise-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegaliseFreedom.com.